Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This morning, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson told Russia to side with the U.S. and like-minded countries on Syria, abandoning its support of the Assad regime. Tillerson is headed to Moscow today. He might already be there by now to manage foreign policy in the wake of the U.S. launched airstrikes against Assad's forces in retaliation for a chemical attack on civilians last week. Today, we're talking about the roles of the U.S. and Russia in the Syrian civil war and what the Trump administration might do going forward. Joining us by phone right now is Washington Post national security reporter and anchor of the Post's military blog, Checkpoint, Dan Lamothe. Welcome, Dan.
Hey, good morning.
The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations recently said that Assad okayed the chemical weapons attack because he knew Russia would have his back. Ambassador Haley went on to say that that changed. What do we know about who has whose back in all of this?
So it's a real fuzzy situation because we're getting mixed messages even from the U.S. administration. Russia has obviously been a supporter of the Assad regime for quite some time. There were Russian forces on this base from which the chemical attack was carried out last week. We've heard that. So the question becomes, did Russia really know about this attack ahead of time? Or if not, when did they learn about it? And at what point does that not become okay anymore for Russia to support the Assad regime to that level?
Is that what Secretary of State Tillerson is saying when he says that it's unclear whether Russia had failed to take seriously its obligation to rid Syria of chemical weapons?
Yes, and I think some of this goes back to 2013, where you had the near strike by the Obama administration after the chemical weapons conversation at that point. And, there was no straight strike back then. They decided over the last several days prior to the strike that they needed to do something now. And the question became, how do you thread that needle where you do some sort of military response, but nothing that's so big that you risk a larger conflict between the Russia and the United States?
There have been suggestions that really what they struck at that airfield wasn't much of anything, that there was so much forewarning of it that the Russians and the Syrians got out anything of much value.
Yes, and I think we had an interesting conversation between several reporters at the Pentagon yesterday and some senior military officials, and they pushed back on that. I mean, their take was basically, yes, the Russians had forewarning. Yes, the Russians may or may not have informed the Syrians. But at the same time, they were able to take out a missile defense site. They were able to take out tens of thousands of gallons of fuel, and that this will at least hurt. This will at least give them some thought about how they should be handling chemical weapons in the future.
We're talking about U.S.-Syria-Russia relations in the wake of the recent chemical attack on civilians in Syria and in the wake of the United States' retaliation of that by sending about 59 Tomahawk missiles to an airfield in Syria. My guest is Dan Lamothe. He's a Washington Post national security reporter and anchor of its military blog, Checkpoint. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The U.S. warned Russia of the retaliation attack, as we mentioned. Why did it do that?
Why did they take the steps last week?
Why did they warn Russia?
I think failing to warn Russia would have made it all but certain that you would have had Russian casualties in this strike. And if you had a number of Russian casualties in this strike, that would have been perilously close to a direct U.S.-Russian war.
So Russia has suspended an agreement that minimizes the risk of in-flight incidents between U.S. and Russian aircraft, I guess, in conjunction with Syria. What's the significance of suspending that agreement at this point? Was it surprising?
I wasn't surprised. It almost seemed like a logical way that Russia could react without, mm-hmm. Reacting in any kind of, conflict sort of way. So that's commonly known as the deconfliction line. And what it does is you've got an American officer and a Russian officer who communicate on a daily basis. And it's basically, we're going to carry out strikes in this location, you're going to carry out strikes in that location. Neither side is stopping anything from happening, but it makes it where, especially where you've got United States planes and Russian planes where operating in closer proximity to each other in places like Manbij, where, you know, both countries have an interest and both countries are, you know, carrying out active operations. They don't want any aerial collisions. And there's also, you know, I think a lesser degree of risk, but at least something that they need to watch in terms of, you know, forces on the ground and not having something like a Russian plane dropping plane on American soldiers.
So this could, the risks of this increase with Russia's suspension of the agreement?
I think at least on the margins, yes. And there are, but there are other ways that they can deconflict. Based on some conversations I had when I traveled with the secretary back in February, we also heard that the deconfliction line was far from a perfect system and had a lot of problems with it. And there was also a lot of issues where there were Russian planes going through airspace with American planes, and the Americans wouldn't really find out ahead of time. So they were definitely using other means to try and watch where the Russian aircraft were, and on at least some occasions, basically moving American planes out of the way as Russian planes would come through an area.
Now, this morning, Rex Tillerson, he said, you know, that get on board with the U.S. He's saying this to Russia or not. What they called it an ultimatum on one report I read this morning. What's going on there?
Ultimatum might be strong, but I think it's definitely a warning. And I think what the United States is trying to do at this point is get Russia to evaluate to what degree they are willing to continue supporting the Assad regime, especially if the Assad regime were to carry out an additional chemical weapons attack that it has similarities to last week's. Now, the flip side argument to that is that the Russians have dropped untold number of bombs on hospitals, on other things in Syria themselves. And, you know, a chemical weapons attack that kills 100 people is horrific and a problem. But, you know, there have been hundreds of thousands of civilians killed in Syria over the last several years, and the United States has largely stood by and watched that happen.
The Tillerson's message to Russia was to side with the U.S. and like-minded countries on Syria, abandoning its support of the Assad regime and the relationship with Iran. What's Iran's role in all of this?
Iran has provided material support to the Syrians for years. Hezbollah has a militia in Syria. It's basically become a de facto force that's also fighting the opposition to Assad. But there were no Iranians on this base, we were told last week. So they seem to be, you know, they're definitely a part of this conversation, but they were not a direct part of the strike last week.
Okay. And Russia, as far as Russia supporting the Assad regime, how much does that have to do with its own air base? I think it's on an island near Syria, or is it right on the mainland?
It's right on the mainland. Okay. It's on the coastal mainland, okay. Right on the Mediterranean. And really, you know, Russia is trying to expand its influence in the Middle East. You know, after years of, you know, kind of looking inward, mm-hmm. Putin a couple of years ago really started stretching back out and really going back to even 2008 when he, you know, Russian forces invaded Georgia. So they are, you know, pushing into areas that they had not been in years. I think they have a real interest in staying in Syria if they can. But the question it becomes, at what point are they no longer able to justify being a part of, you know, Assad's equation here? And that's still an open question.
Is it just me, or is this all very confusing, what's going on in Syria? There's so many factions involved, right?
Oh, yeah. We have yet to even touch today on, you know, the Arab states that have supported the opposition. And, I mean, there are any number of complicated pieces to this. You know, the United States is willing to support opposition forces that are fighting ISIS, but say that they are not supporting opposition forces that are fighting Assad. So, I mean, yes, it's a very complicated situation. And, you know, it has evolved over the last really 6 years, dating back to the Arab Spring, when, you know, opposition forces really started popping up as a real problem for Assad back then.
What do you get the sense is next? What, you know, given the conflicting reports from the Trump administration, are you kind of taking Rex Tillerson at his word right now, but we don't really know what it means?
I think what the strike above all last week was meant to represent was that chemical weapons were a problem and were not going to be something the United States would tolerate anymore. I think it was also meant to be leverage, sort of on the diplomatic side. You know, if that would involve Nikki Haley, that would involve Rex Tillerson, and trying to arm wrestle Russia in particular into looking at this situation a bit differently. Russia was not hit in the strike, but I think they're trying to make Russia think twice about whether or not they still want to be in a place like this, supporting them to that degree. Supposedly on this base, there were, depending on intelligence reports, that were, you know, declassified to the point that they would at least talk about them, anywhere between a dozen and 100 Russian soldiers on this base that the United States hit. They cleared out ahead of time, but, I mean, that's a pretty active Russian presence.
Right, exactly. Now, Russia still suggests there are questions about the source of the chemical attack, and I think they've asked the United Nations to look into this and have to study it. Is there a question?
The United States' perspective on that would be that anybody who's trying to question whether or not Syria carried out chemical weapons attack here is really obfuscating the facts. They pointed to last week after the strike a couple specifics. One line of questioning here has been whether or not a conventional bomb was dropped on something, some sort of chemical site that either ISIS had or the opposition forces to Assad had. The Pentagon says that simply isn't the case, hasn't ever been the case, that they don't have access to sarin and other chemicals like that. The other line of questioning I've heard on this is that, there are water treatment sites where you have these large tanks of chlorine that are used to treat the water in the Middle East. And, you know, did the Syrians accidentally hit some sort of, you know, tank of chlorine? That, too, is seen as just not even remotely realistic by the United States. So they pushed back pretty hard on that. And last week, actually, there was a couple specific slides they released. They showed a crater in the middle of a street where the chemical attack was took place. And they pointed to what they saw as staining around the crater of the bomb and said that specifically represented that this bomb attack was a chemical bomb and wasn't dropped on anything else accidentally. It was dropped in the middle of a street in a populated area, not on a building, not on anything where there would be a question about what they hit. So from the Pentagon perspective, that a lot of those questions, I mean, they're twisting of the facts.
And any sense about whether the United Nations will take this up?
I think at some point that it's going to be hard for them to not take it up. But what they're going to do with that is, I think, a much more, you know, open question.
Gotcha. Fred in Columbus, you're on the air with Dan Lamoth from The Washington Post. Go ahead, Fred.
Just a basic background question. I keep hearing that Iran is supplying Syria, but they don't share a border. How does that happen?
Iran has spread its influence into states ranging from Syria to South America. So it's not a surprise that they would get involved here. They are a state sponsor of terrorism. They are a country that has looked for ways to spread their influence. So I wasn't surprised to see that. They've been involved in any number of countries for, at least a decade at this point.
Thanks a lot, Fred, for the question. Dan Lamoth, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's Dan Lamoth. He's a Washington Post national security reporter and anchor of its military blog, Checkpoint. Coming up, more on the U.S.-Russia-Syria issue. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about U.S., Russian, and Syrian relations today in the wake of the chemical attack by the Syrian government, or allegedly by the Syrian government, against civilians last week, and the retaliation by the Trump administration over the weekend. Joining us is political scientist and the chair of the Peace Studies and Conflict Resolution at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University, Christopher Gelpe. Welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
And by phone from Washington, D.C., Vice President for Policy and Research at the nonpartisan think tank, the Middle East Institute, Paul Salem. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me as well.
I kind of wanted to start at a little bit at the beginning, and we can jump around after that. But what is the foundation, Chris Gelpe, for the current U.S. policy regarding the civil war in Syria?
I don't think it's at all clear what the foundation is. You know, there's been a controversy over this since it began, with sort of many policymakers pushing for intervention, excuse me, to try to alleviate some of the human suffering, but others who are skeptical of our ability to do anything to make the situation better. And it's been interesting to see, this is one of the few issues that we really don't see divide by party, because I think you see today a lot of Republicans standing up for things that Donald Trump is doing that are essentially similar to things that Hillary Clinton wanted to do. And so this isn't really a divide that matches up on party lines. And instead, we've just seen this constant tension. And so we have this kind of halfway intervention that is almost the worst of both worlds, I would say.
Right. Paul Salem, the issue of relieving the suffering in Syria is getting more and more attention lately, but it's been an issue all along. It's very difficult to help out in Syria, isn't it?
Well, the issue of relieving the suffering of civilians had sort of emerged into a global principle called responsibility to protect. In the last couple of decades, we saw it in the war in Bosnia under the Clinton administration, and we saw it under the Obama administration in their support for an intervention in Libya. And the principle was there was to protect against the massacre of civilians in the eastern city of Benghazi. When the issue rose again in Syria, there were two factors. One is that the UN Security Council, with vetoes from Russia and China, refused to go along with strong, decisions about that in Syria. And when the Obama administration was faced with the issue, that split into two issues. One was the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime in 2013, when President Obama threatened to bomb and then backed down, but ended up with what he thought was a satisfactory U.S.-Russian-Syrian agreement for Syria to give up all of its chemical weapons. After that 2013 chemical weapons agreement, it became clear that U.S. policy was not going to engage to protect civilians, and that Assad continued to slaughter his own civilians with the use of quote-unquote conventional weapons, and that seemed to be sadly okay with the Obama administration. Here now, with the Trump administration, I would agree that we don't currently have a clear foundation for a policy, but we have a few actions that have been taken, just over the last few days, particularly over the use of chemical weapons. It's not clear, because there have been contradictory statements from the administration. Sean Spicer said yesterday that the U.S. would intervene if Assad used barrel bombs against his own people, and he's used thousands of those barrel bombs over the past years, and then that was then denied by the White House. So it's really not clear if the White House is only going to react against the use of banned chemical weapons, because chlorine is being currently used by the Assad regime, and that's not technically a banned chemical weapon, and the U.S. is not reacting, or will the Trump administration move into a position sort of more to protect civilians. Secretary Tillerson has talked about safe zones, or what he calls stabilization zones, in northern Syria and southern Syria.
Yeah. Christopher Gelpe, how much does this factor in, that there is no clear, not only is this on piggybacking on a foundation that was a little shaky
from the Obama administration, but now from day to day, the messages we're getting from the Trump administration change. How does that affect the ability to do foreign policy, the likes of what Rex Tillerson's doing in Moscow right now?
I think it utterly cripples our ability to conduct foreign policy. But I think this is a longstanding problem for the United States, and the Trump administration is proving to be not as different from its predecessors as we might have thought on the on these grounds, that the United States just – U.S. leaders have a really hard time facing up to the fact that we do not have the capacity to solve a lot of problems in the world, but we almost always have the capacity to make those problems worse. And so in our half-hearted efforts to try to make it better, we generally end up making it worse, and I think that's what we're doing now.
What are your thoughts about that, Paul Salem? Is the United States making things worse right now?
Well, I think that was the sort of philosophy of President Obama and some of his team. And I remember meeting with some of them, and they said, name me one time in history where a U.S. action in the Middle East helps things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very sort of false, you know, sometimes it hurts, sometimes it helps. Getting to Syria, the fact of the matter is, whatever series of U.S. actions or inactions over the past 6 years up to basically last week, we've ended up with really a extremely dangerous, very, very untenable and dangerous situation. The biggest humanitarian disaster since World War II. Large refugee flows that are straining countries in the region have already impacted Europe, have impacted the European Union, have also impacted things politically in the U.S. and elsewhere. It has led to the biggest resurgence of terrorist groups, even more than the days of 9/11, and it is still ongoing. So, yes, sometimes intervention makes things worse, sometimes better, but what I think what is clear is that the current situation that is partly the result of a set of factors, including U.S. sort of inaction, this is not an okay situation. I think that's a realization that many of Obama's team came to, but President Obama was insistent that the U.S. does not get involved. That is the attitude that President Trump came into office with, that let the Russians deal with it, let Assad deal with it. That's fine. But I think his national security team sort of has informed him otherwise. The situation is far more complex the few weeks since he's been president. And then he did apparently react quite strongly and emotionally to what happened during the chemical weapons attack. I think there are a number of things that the U.S. can do if the administration develops a coherent strategy. I wrote something on Monday. The title of it was Airstrikes in Search of a Strategy. It's not yet clear that the administration has a comprehensive strategy, which should not involve much military action, but could involve some military pressure, some diplomatic and political efforts. President Obama made a great example of getting, through a combination of pressure and good diplomacy, getting to a nuclear deal with Iran, getting Prime Minister Maliki to step aside during the crisis in Iraq and the rise of ISIS. So I do think that politics, diplomacy can work and can help mitigate difficult situations, but it has to be forceful as well.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Chris Jobe, but it seems like the Trump administration's most steadfast, consistent, always there, at least now, is military advisors. There doesn't seem to be a lot of other people in the administration with the depth of experience that the military has. And I wonder how that changes the dynamic.
That's true, although I'm not sure that I would expect that to lead to this sort of policy, because this kind of action is not generally the sort of military activity that military officers like. This is not the kind of mission that they want. And I think you've seen in the Pentagon since the end of the combat, American combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, you've seen the Pentagon really shift away from trying to do counterinsurgency, trying to do nation building. They don't want those missions. So I'm not sure that's the explanation for what's going on here.
But Steve Bannon, the president's one of his chief advisors, he's now off the close military council, but he was not in favor of something like this either. So you wonder where is it coming from?
I do wonder where it's coming from. I think there is some chance that someone like, say, H.R. McMaster would be a supporter of an attack like this. He is someone who is more supportive of counterinsurgency operations than many other U.S. military officers. So it's also possible that Trump himself, from seeing those images, really changed his mind, the images of the chemical attack. That would be somewhat surprising. I think the notion of a so-called CNN effect is generally overblown. But in this case, he certainly did talk very specifically about that attack.
And the children and so forth.
Correct.
Right. Some people are waiting for another shoe to drop after the president ordered the missile strike on the Syrian airfield. What about you, Paul Salem? What are your thoughts about that? What should we be waiting for next? I mean, maybe it's happening right now with Rex Tillerson in Moscow. Maybe that's the next shoe.
Well, certainly there are two, at least two tracks. I don't expect another shoe in the sense I don't think the U.S. is eager or prepping another attack anywhere. I think it really was kind of a sudden and, maybe for even many people in the administration, unexpected that President Trump would react this way and order this strike. But I think the U.S.-Russian track is one of the major ones that the Trump administration and President Putin are trying to figure out. Trump certainly is a negotiator. He likes to think of himself as a counterpuncher and a tough negotiator. So he wants to go into talks with Putin with both the positive that, we can work together, but also that I can be tough, and if you don't work with me, there is a price. And you can see that messaging in Secretary Tillerson's statements, Nikki Haley, and others. I think there's going to be a steep learning curve. I think this administration, sort of came into office feeling it really didn't need to have a Syria policy. Trump was saying it's basically none of our business. Let Putin and the others figure it out. We don't really care. Now, suddenly, the president has put his own administration in the middle of it. And as he has said, I'm kind of responsible for it now. Now they have to scramble and develop a Syria policy. I think their ideal vision is that Russia would drop Assad and they would shift completely, as Secretary Tillerson is saying. They must. I think that's completely unrealistic. I think President Putin has made his choices to be with the Iranians, with Hezbollah, and with Assad's regime in Syria. But I think that they might be able to find some common ground, possibly on de-escalation, on safe zones in the north and south, without probably making much progress on removing Assad or having any final settlement. So more like a de-escalation, stabilization, freezing of the conflict rather than any major breakthrough. Russia, on the other hand, feels that they can't drop Assad. It's the card they hold in negotiations. They're very eager for better relations with the Trump administration. After all, they want sanctions lifted off of them. And there's some reports from Moscow that the Russians are furious with the Assad regime for the chemical attack and for really ruining what could have been a nice honeymoon for Putin with the Trump administration.
Christopher Jelby?
I think the point about there needing to be a steep learning curve is exactly right. Unfortunately, I don't think anyone in the Trump administration or any previous U.S. administration shows any ability to actually have a steep learning curve. We seem to have learned almost nothing from a whole series of disastrous policy failures, even things that were seen as big successes at the time, like Libya, where we toppled Gaddafi. Libya is not better off today because we did that. And I can't imagine any solution, even if we were able, say, to persuade Putin to back away from Assad and Assad fell, which I think is as Paul said, extremely unrealistic that we would do that. Even if that happened, there's no reason to believe that we could put anybody in power who would be any better than Assad for American interests, for providing stability. The next strongest actor in the area is ISIS, who's worse than Assad. So it just baffles me that we continue to go down this road of trying to solve insoluble problems.
And then I think about how many years ago was it that there was the quote unquote Arab Spring and this whole opening up of the Middle East. And it just seems like in every single case now, it's been a disaster.
Yeah, Tunisia's not entirely a disaster.
But that was the very first, wasn't it?
Correct.
Yeah,
yes, that's where it started.
Maybe that was the only place that was going to really work.
So, right. But to the extent that Tunisia did work, it had nothing to do with U.S. intervention
exactly.
or U.S. policy. Anywhere that we intervened, it only made things worse.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about that, Paul Salem?
Well, I was troubled by Obama administration sort of reflections, and I'm not going to name names, but one of his top advisors at some point said, I look at the Middle East, he says, and I look where we did intervene, Iraq, it didn't work out well. Where we did not intervene, Syria, it did not work out well. Where we partially intervened, Libya, it did not work out well. The troubling conclusion that he came to is that there is nothing to be done. That is not the correct lesson. I could go on and on about definitely how complicated the Middle East is, how many problems there are, how devilish it is. To try to even contain some of these problems. But it's been, you know, the fact, you know, what by the U.S. also doing nothing, that's an action that doesn't solve things or help things either. I think it's much more, you know, as in many, you know, very difficult political and security issues, there's not going to be silver bullet, there's no perfect solution. But in each case, I think the U.S., as it's learning, I think now in Iraq, that there is maybe a manageable middle road, keeping some troops there, helping the government stand up again, push back ISIS. Iraq is not going to be Switzerland, but it's better off than being half occupied by ISIS and in a total civil war. In the U.S., there is no guarantee of the path forward, but there's certainly a slew of things that the U.S. could work on and could try at least to de-escalate the horrible genocide and bloodshed that's taking place, to deter Assad. We are already fighting ISIS, and that fight is proceeding well. I warn against putting things in black and white, that it's hopeless or everything's going to be great. As in most political things, it's terribly complicated, but resigning, which probably was what the Trump administration would have liked to have done, that was sort of the Trump trope, that it's none of our business, we'll walk away. Sadly, the world, you know, is at our doorstep, and often you can't walk away from it.
So I want to be clear in saying I'm not saying that we should walk away from the Syrian people in the sense of trying to help in a humanitarian sense with the refugee crisis and so on. So I do think that the United States can do things to alleviate the suffering of some civilian people as they are fleeing this conflict. But and while I agree that there are a lot of things that the United States can do militarily, I think that we ought not to do any of them unless we have a reason to believe that they're going to make things better. And if one thinks about, say, just war theory, for example, one ought not to use military force unless it has a reasonable possibility of success. And I don't see any military options for the United States in this conflict that have any reasonable possibility of success, including bombing ISIS out of existence. Because even if we were able to topple, say, both Assad and ISIS, there's no reason to believe that whatever comes next would be any better than that for the United States.
Paul Salem,
if I just may make a quick statement, I do think, and I agree with Chris, that protecting civilians is something we can stand for. And I do believe it is possible and was, you know, seriously contemplated on the Obama administration, as being talked about now, to deter the Assad regime from bombing its own people and causing, you know, half the population to be refugees and 500,000 killed. Deterrence is a possibility. I would not advocate war in the sense of trying to, you know, go in or invade or anything like that. But our inaction has empowered and enabled the Assad regime to do something less done maybe under the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot. I think as a human being, that's not acceptable.
We will continue our conversation. For now, I have to say goodbye to Paul Salam, Vice President for Policy and Research at the Middle East Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann. Take care.
Take care. We'll continue our conversation coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the role of the U.S. in Syria following American missile strikes against a Syrian government airbase last week. The U.S. attack was in retaliation for a deadly chemical weapons attack that killed at least 70 civilians. Still with us is political scientist and the chair of peace studies and conflict resolution at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at OSU, Christopher Jelpy. Chris, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And also joining us by phone is Senior Research Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation, James Phillips. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Jim, you write, this strike was an appropriate, proportional, and carefully calibrated response from the Assad regime's repeated use of illegal chemical weapons. Some people think, a lot of people think, this was just a one-off attack, possibly simply based on the emotional response by President Trump to photos of people who had died in that chemical attack.
Right. And I think it's very dangerous to have an emotional response to the continued tumult and human rights violations in the Middle East, because they never stop. And we saw back in the 1990s, another president had an emotional response to the pictures of starving Somalians, and President Bush ordered Operation Restore Hope, which was an emergency food lift that eventually was transformed into a nation-building experiment by the next administration, and that resulted in a very disastrous experience in Mogadishu, because it turned out in order to feed Somalians, the U.S. felt it had to fight the warlords that were diverting food away from starving Somalians. And then we got in this war with a warlord by the name of Adid, who was trained, his men were trained by Al-Qaeda. And actually, Osama bin Laden, who was in exile in Sudan back then, perceived the U.S. Airlift of food to be an act of imperialism. So Al-Qaeda's first terrorist attack against Americans was in December 1992 against U.S. Marines transiting Yemen en route to Somalia. It was a failed attack, but nonetheless, demonstrated that in the Middle East, no good deed goes unpunished.
Right. I mean, there's not even a decent track record in the Middle East at this point for the United States.
Yeah. And for me, if this is a one-off strike, it could be deemed successful if it deters Assad from using chemical weapons again. What I worry about is that this limited symbolic strike will be the opening of a military campaign to oust President Assad, and I think that would be a bridge too far.
Now, Russia has suspended, in response to that attack, they suspended an agreement that minimizes the risk of in-flight incidents between the U.S. and Russian aircraft. Is there any concern on your part, Jim Phillips, that means, okay, so what if somebody accidentally blows somebody out of the sky, or they collide in midair, or something like that? Could this increase tensions between the United States and Russia? Do we want to even go there?
Yeah, I think this is a calculated move by Putin to raise the stakes, along with his dispatching a naval warship in a kind of a latter-day case of gunboat diplomacy. But I think, in a sense, this is Putin cutting off his nose to spite his face, because if that channel is totally cut off, that'll limit the amount of warning time that Russian military advisors or air units have to avoid a possible future attack if Assad repeats his chemical attacks.
You mean that the Russians could be caught in the crosshairs of that?
Yeah, I think that's possible. The U.S. did warn the Russians at that base, and they did, in fact, evacuate. But if this deconfliction channel is completely cut off, and there are conflicting reports about whether it actually still is being operated, but if it's completely cut off, then that would raise the stakes and the possible risks of a Russian-American military clash inside Syria.
Christopher Jalpi?
I think Jim's exactly right that it does raise the risks for Putin by getting rid of this deconfliction channel. But I think that's exactly how these sorts of threats work, right? This is a game of brinksmanship that Putin is playing by saying, I am now willing to take on this risk that we're going to run into each other in Iraq, and Putin is gambling that Trump will blink before he does, that he's willing to take that risk, and he's basically daring Trump to take it as well.
And what's Trump supposed to do? I mean, Trump, he could just do nothing at this point, right? I mean, what is he expecting Trump to do in response to that?
Well, I think what he wants Trump to do is to not engage in any more of these strikes
again,
and to make sure that, you know, that Russian jets are able to operate freely in order to support Assad. And, you know, he wants to keep Trump out so that he can push Assad to victory in the civil war. And he's betting that Trump doesn't really have the stomach to kill Russian soldiers.
James Phillips, when all said and done, who do you visualize as who's left? Who's, you know, who's standing in the end in all of this? Do you see the Assad regime enduring through the war and ending up on top? Or do you think, are you in the camp that they must fall?
I think the Assad regime eventually will fall, but I think it's going to take a lot longer than people expect, because it's a lot more ruthless. It's not going to cut and run when it loses substantial territory, and its adversaries are very divided. ISIS is probably the strongest, but probably a close second is the Al Qaeda franchise, the Nusra Front, which recently renamed itself to the Jabhat Fatah al-Sham, or the Front for, or the Organization for Conquering Syria. And that organization has put down deeper roots than ISIS and could survive to pick up the pieces after ISIS is militarily dismantled.
Chris?
This is one of the things that's very strange to me about this whole policy, is that, I mean, Jim is exactly right about who the other prominent players are. So all of the other actors who would have any reasonable capacity to control Syria are worse for the United States than Assad. So it's not clear to me, as bad as Assad is, it's not clear to me why the United States is so bent on regime change, or what we think we could possibly put in place. And even from the perspective of the Syrian people, it seems to me that an Assad that is actually in control of his state, as bad as that is for the Syrian people, is probably better than the war that's going on right now. So I don't understand what the goal would even be of trying to topple Assad.
I have an email from Mary. She says, Syria apparently committed a war crime against humanity. Why was it up to the United States alone to punish them? James Phillips?
I don't think it's up to the U.S. alone, but the U.S. is one of the few countries that had the means to effectively halt those chemical weapons. Other countries have condemned the attack, and I wouldn't argue that the U.S. should become, you know, a global policeman. But in cases like this, you know, where, when it's clear there is a rogue regime using unacceptable weapons that is very hostile to the U.S. and its allies, then I think it is incumbent on the U.S. to take action.
I'm also a little bit puzzled by the focus on chemical weapons. It's, again, if we're thinking about sort of—
They've killed a lot more people a lot of other ways, yeah.
If the goal here is to alleviate the suffering of the Syrian people and try to have some sort of good governance occur in Syria, as fanciful as that might seem, if that's the goal, it's not clear to me why we should be so worried about chemical weapons. It's from a moral standpoint, it's not obvious to me why it's worse to gas people to death than it is to kill them with shrapnel. And certainly he's been killing them with shrapnel for a long time, and a lot more people have died from bombs than from sarin gas. So why the United States thinks that this is a super important red line to enforce is also not clear to me.
What do you think about that, James Phillips?
Well, I would differentiate between chemical weapons and others, in part because the U.S. already was on record for warning that it would take action if those chemical weapons were used back during in 2013 mm-hmm. during the Obama administration, but also because this is a regime that supports terrorism, and if it feels free to use these kind of weapons inside Syria against its own people, then it also may feel free to pass these weapons on to surrogate terrorist groups for use outside Syria. And I think that's something that should be nipped in the bud.
An email from Marie. She writes, it seems so much of the geopolitical focus about the Syria missile strike has been on Russia. What role or influence did other countries in the region, especially Israel and Turkey, play? Christopher Jelpy?
I'm sorry. What role did Israel or Turkey play with regard to what aspect of the conflict?
The aspect of the missile strike. That so much of it, the missile strike is the geopolitical focus about the Syria missile strike has been on Russia.
Well, I think that's true. But I think that's because the focus of the missile strike is on the chemical weapons and the support for the support for the use of chemical weapons that Assad gets from the Russians, and the Russians are seen as the only actors who have any chance of preventing Assad from using those. So that's why I think there's a focus on Russia. While Israel certainly has a lot at stake in the outcome of the war in Syria, as does Turkey, I don't see them as especially involved in this particular aspect of it.
And how much does Russia figure into this in the end? I mean, how much is how many plates do we have in the air at this point, James Phillips?
Well, Russia, since September 2015, has been launching an air campaign that has greatly aided Assad and helped prop him up. But it's interestingly, flying beneath the radar in this crisis is Iran, which plays the key role on the ground in recovering territory for the Assad regime. They dispatched up to 8,000 Iranian Revolutionary Guards and more than 20,000 Shiite militiamen from Hezbollah, based in Lebanon, and from Iraqi Shiite militias, many of which were killing Americans and fighting the Iraqi government during the U.S. Occupation there, and also Shiite militiamen from Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Iran has been relatively quiet here, but Russia is perceived to be in the driver's seat because of its key role in the air.
Okay. Well, that's all that we have time for today. I'm sure we'll continue our conversation going forward in the future. For now, thank you, James Phillips, for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
James Phillips, Senior Research Fellow for Middle Eastern Affairs at the Heritage Foundation. Also with us, Christopher Jelpy. Thanks so much, Chris, for joining us today.
Good to talk with you.
Christopher Jelpy, political scientist and the chair of peace studies and conflict resolution at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies at Ohio State University. That's it for All Sides. Thanks for listening.